It doesn't. Mission.
You're listening to This Week in Radio News. Radio news about radio waves, radio art, and more. I'm Tom Rowe, your host, and we'll travel across the ether to hear what's going on in radio news. This is Tom Rowe with the radio news about radio waves. Politico.com is reporting a federal appeals court May 7th ruled the National Security Agency program to collect information on billions of telephone calls made or received is illegal. A three-judge panel from the Second Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals in New York unanimously ruled a law Congress passed permitting the collection of information relevant to terrorism investigations does not authorize the so-called bulk collection of phone records on the scale of the NSA program. The judges did not address whether the program violated the Constitution. The Second Circuit, which acted in a case brought by the American Civil Liberties Union, is the first appeals court to rule on the legality of the telephone metadata program. The program was first discovered in leaks from Edward Snowden in 2013. In a 97-page ruling, the court held that a provision of the USA Patriot Act, known as Section 215, cannot be interpreted to allow the bulk collection of domestic calling records. Section 215 and the Patriot Act run out on June 1st, and Congress is currently debating renewal or changes. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, has advocated for renewing the program, while other senators want to curtail some NSA programs, the New York Times reports. Previously, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, FISA, the court who hears arguments from the government only, interpreted Section 215 to allow the government wide latitude in the searches. Congress and the president are now forced to act on the issue. John Egerton in Broadcasting and Cable magazine reports that the Federal Communications Commission last week announced $1.7 billion in subsidies to the largest telecom providers in the United States, hoping to bring broadband to 8.5 million Americans in rural locations. Quote, the offer to the rural operations of the largest telecom providers, known as price cap carriers, would provide ongoing support for networks that can deliver broadband at speeds of at least 10 megabits per second for downloads and 1 megabit per second uploads to nearly 9 million rural residents nationwide, unquote, said the FCC's press release about the subsidies. Quote, the funding represents a 71% increase from the current funding for these areas, but is accomplished without increasing the size of the Universal Service Fund or increasing ratepayer fees, unquote. The funds are meant for census tracts where the cost of providing broadband exceeds $52.50 per month and that are not served by unsubsidized competitors offering at least 4 megabits per second downloads and 1 megabit per second uploads. According to the FCC, nearly 1 in 3 rural Americans lack access to 10 megabits per second downloads and 1 megabits per second uploads, compared to only 1 in 100 urban Americans that lack such service. This is Tom Rowe reporting for Wavefarm Radio and WGXC. The American Civil Liberties Union last week unveiled the California version of their app that lets users record interactions with the police and automatically upload them to the ACLU servers. The civil rights group has released similar apps in New York, New Jersey, Mississippi, Oregon, Nebraska, and Missouri. The reason they are released on a state-by-state basis, Tim Cushing reports at TechDirt, is to align with slightly different local laws. The Mobile Justice California app is for iPhones and Androids and is in English and Spanish. It does just a few important things. Once you take it out of your pocket and open the app, then when the large red record button in the middle of the screen is pressed, video is recorded on the phone and copy transmitted simultaneously to the ACLU server. Then when the stop button is pressed, a report screen appears where one can type in details. The video and the information are reviewed by ACLU staff members, with the reports treated as confidential and privileged legal communications. The videos, though, may be shared with the news media, community organizations, or the general public. Carl Bode of TechDirt tweeted last week, so in the last 2 years, AT&T has been fined for defrauding the IP relay system, which helps the deaf, fined for profiting handsomely off of scamming and cramming and for actually hiding those practices, sued for deceptive throttling of unlimited data customers, and now for effectively defrauding the Lifeline program designed to help the poor. Bode explained more in Tech Dirt about AT&T's recent missteps. On April 29th, the FCC announced that AT&T and its former subsidiary Southern New England Telephone will pay $10.9 million in penalties for overbilling the FCC's Lifeline program, a program which helps ensure low-income consumers have access to a phone line. But AT&T has several other recent bouts with regulators. Last year, the Federal Trade Commission sued AT&T for slowing down customer data speeds after they've used up certain amount of data on a single month. Quote, unlimited means unlimited, unquote, said FTC Chairman Edith Ramirez at the time. Also last year, the FTC fined the company $105 million because AT&T Mobility allegedly charged consumers mobile phone bills for third-party subscriptions or services that they never ordered or authorized. In 2012, the Department of Justice filed a lawsuit against AT&T for bilking taxpayers out of millions of dollars by abusing IP relay subsidies. An IP relay allows the hearing impaired to send text-based messages to phone numbers, which are then read by operators. Since 2004, scammers realized that this was an opportunity to make almost totally anonymous calls paid for by taxpayers. The FCC pays telephone companies $1.50 per minute on IP relay calls. Bode says companies have started grumbling that Travis LeBlanc, chief of the FCC's Enforcement Bureau, quote, is being too hard on the industry, unquote, with a major profile in the National Journal. Brandon Sasso notes there that LeBlanc also had T-Mobile pay $90 million for placing charges on consumers' bills, that Marriott Hotels paid $600,000 for blocking its customers' Wi-Fi hotspots, and CenturyLink and Verizon were fined millions for a software glitch that blocked 911 calls for 6 hours. Sasso writes, quote, two telecom industry advocates complained that LeBlanc has been successful at grabbing headlines but less effective at actually curbing bad behavior. By not being lenient on companies that self-report violations, he is discouraging future companies from coming forward, they said. Quote, the FCC's new approach will discourage cooperation and self-disclosure, and it's going to force regulatees to beef up on litigation instead of compliance with the rules, unquote, one industry lobbyist said. Quote, ultimately, that's a poor use of resources for taxpayers, and it will lead to a worse result for consumers, unquote. Make up your own mind. More information is at newsroom.free103.9.org. Since the days of Thomas Edison, humans have made audio programs of variable lengths, usually 28 or 58 minutes long, and listeners, usually through radios, have listened. Now, though, many people listen to audio programs through other digital means, subscribing with an RSS feed or purchasing the sounds from an iTunes store. The term podcast itself is, if one's short-term memory has failed, is a proprietary term for a piece of hardware that barely still exists. Still, the term was bandied about a lot in the past year with the popularity and media chatter about Serial, first program to reach 5 million streams or downloads in iTunes history. The Pew Research Center reports that in 2014, three new podcast networks were launched by public radio groups: Radiotopia by PRX, Soundworks by PRI, and Infinite Guest by APM. Now the New Yorker and WNYC are working together to produce a new national radio show and podcast set to premiere in the fall. Now in 2015, a Pew Research study indicates 17% of Americans have listened to a podcast in the past month, up from 9% in 2008. But on the other hand, only one-third of all Americans have ever listened to an entire podcast. So we aren't talking about the penetration of television or radio just yet. But now podcasting is being marketed to advertisers through giant radio networks such as iHeartMedia. Mark Ramsey wrote that, quote, last week, iHeartMedia launched its first Soundfront, where they debuted a slate of new original programs that were widely misinterpreted by the media. For example, the headline in Ad Age read, iHeartMedia shows off original podcasts at Soundfront. While that is technically accurate, what's much more accurate is the deeper reality of iHeartMedia's strategy, which few outside iHeartMedia and their advertisers seem to understand. It's a platform strategy, as in content across every platform. Every piece of content iHeartMedia creates will live in some form or another across all of its platforms, thus magnifying the reach and engagement for that content and also magnifying the opportunities for advertisers, unquote. So the typical internet story is playing out as DIY ethos of podcasting gets the throw everything at it corporate approach.
Thank you.
This is Tom Rowan. You're tuned into Yannick Schaefer's Found Soundscape, 24-hour streaming assemblage of field recordings collected in 1,000 different places by 100 different artists. Any one point, three different feeds are mixed, plus a fourth feed, a live mic in Yannick Schaefer's studio. You can go to foundsoundscape.com for more about what you're listening and to listen to it more.
Bonjour.
Where are you at?
I am in the shed at the end of my garden. We call that a studio in Walton-on-Thames on the left edge of London.
You're joining us today. We've been listening to Found Soundscape.
Is that, I'm glad about that.
Tell us about how did the inception of Found Sound come about?
Found Soundscape?
Found Soundscape, yes. Excuse me.
I was research fellow and visiting professor at Oxford Brookes University within the last year or so. And I was looking for a project to present that had some value. And opposite the department was the student radio station. And I said, because I do I've been doing a lot of radio transmission artworks in the last 5 or so years. It's my current thing, really, more than turntables they used to be. And I said to the department, has anyone ever been over to talk to the radio station? I said, no. I said, okay, well, I could maybe make use of it. It's right there on my doorstep. So I knocked on the door and I found out that they only broadcast during working hours, 4 days in the week, which meant they had this radio station that was free airspace all weekend, all night. And they had a detached presence in their community, is on and off. So I thought I could do something to fill in that empty air and make it something, a resource maybe for the students on campus. That's how it began. It carries on.
And so it evolved into what it, because it's not that now.
No.
The end didn't result that same way.
That was the inception. And it got me on to thinking about radio essentially being 120 years old, roughly, started analog, and it was the first time that one sound could be heard by many people in the same place, but it had a locale, a community, based on the transmitter power. But in these days, and I didn't know what radio art was in the last 15 years, thinking about what it was, and these days everything's gone digital, and and how, what is radio in a digital age? Because it's not a community anymore, it's a global presence. So digital radio, and I remember when people first got them, you know, I learned that the bandwidth used on digital actually is really low. It's like 96 kilobits per second or something. It's quite low quality. But digital offered more capacity than there were programs to fill. So it was very efficient. I think you can fit 8 digital radio stations into 1 analog bandwidth on the air. And I remember going to someone's house and they had a new digital radio. I didn't want to touch it, but they were playing this. It was just this sound of a countryside coming out of the out of it. I said, "What's that?" He said, "That's the Birdsong channel or something." So it was just a not a program, not music, not talk radio. It was just some way you could stick it on, and it created a pleasant underscore ambience to your personal space at home. But it died. It eventually got taken over. The bandwidth's been used. So I thought I'd do an online radio station project that and I thought, well, I know a lot of sound recordists all over the world. They all avidly record the world around them. Maybe I just ask everyone to send in some sound that they like that's calm, and I'll collage it together and I'll make this simple one-click portal. You can just click and leave on, and it underscores your personal spaces with found sound places. There, Tom, that's the story.
So now it's 3 mixes of or 3 streams that are mixed together of the 100 or so artists, the sounds that were sent in, plus a live microphone too.
Yeah, I mean, keep it simple. 3 has always been a magic number in all my projects. 3 arm turntable, 3 random play CD players early on. I think it's a very cute number for collage. So I'll play them all at the same time, quiet, medium, and full volume. I'll mix in some quiet, empty tracks so that they'll shuffle mode each of the channels, the 3 channel piece shuffle modes. So you get this ever-changing work. Originally, I wanted to collect 100 artists. They can send in whatever they like. Someone sent in 52 sounds. Well done, them. Some people sent in 1 short sound. But I was open to anyone from anyone in the world. Serendipity, send us what you got. And all those people, primarily Western-based people, they'd traveled all over the globe. So they collected sounds from every corner, brought them home. They're sitting around on their hard drives. So why not share it? And it went really well. I had just 100 people. And now I've got about 140 people, including a lot more ladies. And Pauline Oliveros is on side, and Brian Eno and Chris Watson and some fantastic figures. Hildegard Westerkamp, who used to work as a research assistant to R. Murray Schafer when he founded the World Soundscape Project. She's on board. And it links to R. Murray Schafer's kind of conceptions, I think. Turned out that he was born within a short area in Ontario where my dad was born at the same time. And they're both called Schafer. Must be related. I've written him an email. I haven't got anything back yet. I wrote Barry's publisher. So, it seems to connect those dots.
Were you surprised by, or I guess, were there any trends in the, were there a lot of water sounds? Were there a lot of lightning and thunder? What different things did you hear a preponderance of?
I am remembering the funny things right now, but I think the most popular sound was cicadas. Phil Niblock sent some cicadas. Brian Eno's got some night singing insects like that. Quite a few people sent that in. Other than that, it's really very varied, really varied. And it's, you know, a proof of concept. It is very diverse, and they're all found curious things, including the sounds of, you know, electromagnetic radio waves coming and hitting the earth and things from the sun.
It's not all people with microphones out in the woods. There's some digital recordings. There's it seems like broadcast and transmissions in some of them.
Yeah, exactly. Just a found sound can be some sonic space I spin with my pedals based on taking off an LP or something. That's a found sound. So there's a little bit of musical content. I wanted to kind of not have it pure field recording, although some people complain that, you know, it's not artwork and unless it's just field recordings, which was a bit ridiculous. Someone sent in the sound of him having a pee, and then amazingly the sound of his son having a shower, his teenager down the road, down the corridor, having a shower, whistling, being happy, having a happy shower was the name of the file. And I thought that was amazing because if you add visuals to that, it's like, you know, you're up in court. Just take it as a sound. It's suggestive. But because sound is suggestive, it conjures up these images in your mind that you can't see. That's what I love about it. Since my early days back at the Royal College of Art studying architecture, you know, sound you hear through the window, but you can't see the cars or the people chatting has always intrigued me. Dissociated sound, I call it. So he sent the sound of a shower. Someone sent in, a local lady artist sent in the sound of her breast pump in the maternity ward at hospital. That's pretty suggestive too. It just sounds like a... It's not sexy. But, you know, you hear the story. I just love those elements that come in. Like in recorded delivery when I posted the sound activated tape recorder, it hit the postal workers at 5 a.m. They're all men in a small room scanning parcels, and they talked about the sexual antics they wished that they'd experienced the night before, quite crudely and rudely. And I found that happened to be my parcel lying in a room in a post office, and I caught it. I love things like that.
We have
hello.
Yeah, I don't know if you can hear it. We're playing the stream underneath, and it just got very loud at the moment.
Well, I've got Found Soundscape playing in the shed behind me.
And where is the microphone in the studio where you are, or the open mic?
It's my laptop.
Ah, your laptop. Ah, so
seems
we're
to work quite well in other events. A limitation of sound, I've always found fascinating, like recorded delivery. It's quite muffled. It sounds a bit like a cheap microphone stuck in a box, and that's what it is. You know, it tells you through its imperfection of the quality of the sound that it's tangible. You can understand it. And then the tape used to go zhoop, zhoop, when it stopped and started with its sound activation during the night. It didn't record the whole thing. It stopped. And when the office was empty and no recording was made, someone unlocked the door, started singing, and it recorded them. So you get these snippets of sonic kind of punctuation in recorded delivery. And that's adds character to the recording. It's not a perfect digital thing that just stops. You can hear the zzz of the tape. I love limitation in sound. It adds character.
And I'm guessing in Found Soundscape, the recording quality or the recording instruments are probably very varied.
Yes, they are varied. I don't give a monkey's what quality you send because it's all character and ambience. So Philip Jeck took his ancient recording phone and walked around the block in Liverpool. It's really low quality. But that's Philip. He's a really low quality audio guy, and it speaks about who he is. Of course, a lot of people fetishize sound recording equipment, so there's some pristine stuff in there too.
It's been the kind of strangest reaction or surprising reaction you've gotten to someone who's listened to this.
My head goes to politics. In terms of people valuing it, I've had some lovely feedback. Nothing jumps out. The most strange reaction was a little news story. I asked anyone to send in sound by a certain time. Just 100 people did by the time it went live. I invited the world. 95 of those people that sent in sound were men, 5 were women. Whatever. It doesn't bother me. It's serendipity. If that's who can be bothered, thank you. And then someone, or a couple of people, mentioned, oh, it's a bit like, it's a bit male heavy, isn't it? And someone wrote up something rude about that. So I tried to make friends with them. And I thought, well, fair enough. Holly Jarvis runs a sound women in sound art forum. So I looked on her page and found a poster for people to submit sounds, women only to submit sounds to a project. I thought, well, that's a bit weird. I wasn't being one sexist. I was open. So I wrote to her and said, what's going on? She said, oh, that was a very particular thing. And we made friends. So I asked her to invite all the women in sound art she knows to submit sounds. We've got about 40 more females come on board, which is a benefit. I've turned the problem into a solution.
And is it spread all over the world? Are there people from Asia and Africa and Australia and Antarctica and
Antarctica. Yes, I've had a Chinese person really having difficulty getting through online, managed to get me some sounds from China, Europe, Japan, Australia, not in general, not Africa, because that generally doesn't come up so far much in our community. So yeah, it's totally global.
So the field recordings and the sound art community seems, you know, and not just probably not just in your case, but has a problem with the lack of women African, probably not too much from the Middle East, I'm guessing, in your project and other projects of this sort.
Absolutely. And there aren't many women in sound arts. I would say it's, you know, biased the other way. So if 5 out of 100 send them in, that's fine. The person I was arguing with had written books about sound art. And I got one of his books, and I looked up in the back how many women were referenced in the index. There was 100 names in the index, and only 5 of them were women.
So he matched your batting average.
Yes,
there.
Totally matched it. Oh, mate, you try and find some women in this area of music. That's what. I don't know, I'm here for an argument. I think it's hilarious. Let's be friends. Should we do something positive, I said.
This is Tom Rowe for This Week in Radio News from Wave Farm and WGXC in upstate New York.